Good afternoon, and welcome to Central Coast Voices, a program sponsored by Action for Healthy Communities in collaboration with KCBX and made possible through the underwriting of Joan Gellert Sargent. I'm your Chris Kington. Yes, I am. I'm your host, Chris Kington Barker. An overwhelming 90% of California voters support a path to citizenship for undocumented immigrants. So where is California and the nation headed with comprehensive immigration reform? While a number of important immigration-related laws have been passed and proposed this past year, many challenges still remain for more than 1.5 million immigrants across the state. Since the implementation of President Obama's recent executive action deferring deportation, what has been the local impact on the Central Coast? The topic of today's Central Coast Voices is the legal perspectives of immigration reform policies and campaigns for immigrants' rights and integration. I'm joined today in the studio by Kevin Gregg, immigration attorney. And Kevin has been here with us before, a couple of years ago. So it's good to see you back, Kevin.
Thank you.
And Hazel Davalos. Did I say that right? Mm-hmm. Organizing director with CAUSE, and CAUSE stands for Central Coast Alliance for a Sustainable Economy, and the president of the Latino Outreach Council. And hopefully joining us soon will be Jacqueline Del Valle Vitti Frederick, who's also an attorney. Today's show is live, and you can be part of our discussion by calling in with your questions and comments. To make sure your comments get on the air, however, please do call in early. The number to call is 781-3875. Again, that's 781-3875. And Kevin, for the purpose of kind of moving forward in the discussion that, you know, we're going to be talking about a lot of things with regard to immigration and reform and what's happening, kind of at the heart of today's show, I first wanted to get your thoughts and comments about some of the major events that have been taking a lot of public time recently, and one, Donald Trump, and I don't know that you can really answer that in some of the comments that he's made, but certainly the murder of the woman in San Francisco and by an illegal immigrant and who was released from police custody and had prior been deported a number of times. Can you talk a little bit about what happened with that and, you know, how that even occurs?
Sure, Chris. This actually covers a lot of different areas of immigration law and its relation with local law enforcement that I'm sure we'll get into a bit more later. But from everything I've read about it, once the facts come out, it'll be a little bit more clear. This gentleman, not sure gentleman is quite the right name, but Juan Francisco Lopez Sanchez had been deported five times beginning in the 1990s for felony drug convictions. In some ways, what happened after that is kind of an example of how the system does and should work under the current law. He was caught two times trying to enter the country illegally, captured both times by Border Patrol without actually making it into the United States to live. Because he had previously been deported, he was arrested by federal agents and was charged with illegal reentry after deportation, which is actually the most charged federal offense. And on two occasions, he was convicted and spent multiple years, 3 or 4 years in jail. So in the past 10 years, I don't believe that he had any days actually living in the United States. All of those reentries resulted in his arrest again. What happened this time is that the city of San Francisco called Immigration and Customs Enforcement, who is responsible for deportation, and said, basically, before you deport him, we have this outstanding warrant from who knows when for a felony marijuana charge, and requested that instead of deportation, he be transferred to San Francisco. ICE doesn't always do that. The U.S. Attorney's Office doesn't have to do that, so I don't know exactly who decided to take him to San Francisco, especially knowing that it is a sanctuary city. But he was transferred to San Francisco. San Francisco has been a sanctuary city for decades.
Explain what a sanctuary city is.
So a sanctuary city is basically a city that has said, up to a degree, and it varies based on the location, we won't work with immigration. We won't work with federal law enforcement. The reasons for that are a variety, and I'm sure we can cover that a little bit more later. But basically, they said, unless this person meets specific circumstances in the city of San Francisco that you can prove to us that they are a violent federal offender, we won't release them to you. So ICE did put on what's called a hold and a request for notification that says, when you are done with this person, we would like to talk with them again. But that's it's a request. It is not a warrant. ICE didn't get a warrant. And because of that, San Francisco apparently took a couple of weeks to look at his record, saw that all of the felony arrests were for drugs and for nonviolent offenses, and said they didn't meet their internal criteria for release to immigration, and a couple of weeks later released him. So the real story is the interplay between local law enforcement and immigration and customs enforcement, rather than the ability to reenter the country, because each time he tried to do that, he was stopped by Customs and Border Protection before he actually made it into the country.
Well, I think it's interesting that you note that he was in jail for the majority of the 10 years.
And I think the facts are still coming out. That's just a timeline that I looked at.
Because that's not reported.
Right. And because it doesn't make for...
Well, it's not newsworthy.
Right. I mean, yeah. There were five deportations. Only two of them had been in the past two 10 years or so. And each time he tried to come back, he was stopped. So I think a lot of the facts are unverified. That's just what I have from reading up on it this week. But I think it changes what the real story is to not whether he reentered the country after deportation.
How long has San Francisco been a sanctuary city?
I believe since the 1990s.
Okay.
And that's because San Francisco has always been San Francisco.
Yeah.
Just to get into a little bit more depth on it.
Hazel, were you going to say something?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, I think... Now a challenge in the aftermath moving forward after this tragedy. I mean, the challenge is that I think we're seeing that this isolated tragedy is being used to as a political pawn, I guess, in this interplay that Kevin alluded to, the interplay between local law enforcement and ICE. And so we're already hearing folks say this is the reason that law enforcement should work hand in hand with ICE, correct? But I think a conversation we can have today is around look at the other side of the coin. Even law enforcement agrees, you know, we're charged with keeping the community safe. We're local. It really behooves us to have trust with the community. And so even the local law enforcement says, you know, we shouldn't be doing ICE's job, ICE's work. And there's been studies that show, I mean, if local law enforcement works very closely with ICE, then it hurts the trust between immigrants and local law enforcement. And so when you imagine if an undocumented immigrant is afraid to call the police because they fear deportation, less crimes are being reported. More criminals are walking free, we're all less safe, regardless of our immigration status. And so there's definitely another side of the coin that I hope we can look at today. But again, it is a tragedy what happened in San Francisco. But before jumping to conclusions, I think it's something we need to look at thoroughly and with a level head.
Well, and it's across the board in the country that ICE and local law enforcement don't work together, correct? I mean, they do. They work in... some kind of collaboration, but...
So that's actually been in transition this past year. Up until, I believe it was May, there was a federal court case that has decreased some of that collaboration. We've seen more deportations in recent years than we have in our entire history's country. And that was mainly based on a program called Secure Communities, which created basically a technology where when someone goes into a jail to get booked, they give their fingerprints. Before, those fingerprints were just sent to the FBI. Now they're also sent to Department of Homeland Security. And at the jail, they get a notice, oh, this person has an immigration history. And ICE would then request a hold, a 48 hours. Hold on to this person. We're going to come pick them up. In May last year, a court case declared that was unconstitutional. These folks were not getting due process or anything. And they basically said these jails cannot hold them. And so just this year, they're moving into a new program called PEPCOM. I believe it stands for Priority Enforcement Program. and which basically now instead of holds asks for notifications. And so the way that, that jails and ICE are working together is if someone has an immigration history and comes into contact with the jail and are being charged with a serious violent crime or a level one crime under ICE's criteria, and maybe Kevin could speak more to what crimes those are, ICE will request a notification of release date. And so the jail can then say, this person's getting released this on Tuesday, come get him. But as he mentioned, it's a request. And so they're in no way obligated to do that. And several counties across the state have, and like San Francisco, have opted to say, you know what? We care more about having trust with the whole community that we serve than working with ICE and doing their work. And so we're not going to turn over people unless they're very serious violent offenders, because we value more being able to have a trust between the immigrant community and our department, to be able to have crimes reported, domestic violence survivors feeling safe to call the police. I mean, there's a whole host of issues to take into account.
Kevin, when we're talking about immigration laws and we're talking about some of the reform and all, we're talking about immigration from all countries.
Right. I think obviously that gets lost sometimes.
Yeah, it gets lost a lot.
And I statistics are notoriously difficult to talk of, to get when we're talking about an undocumented community, because these are not people that are coming forward and volunteering and phone conversation or census reports. But yes, I mean, the number of I believe Mexico makes up a little over 50% of the undocumented community throughout the country. And that's obviously not what a lot of people think. A lot of people would probably guess that it's higher in the 75 to 90%
yes.
range. In fact, last year, there were fewer illegal attempted entries by Mexicans through Mexico than all other countries. Last year there were, I believe last year was the first year that Mexico was not the largest incoming country in the United States. There were more immigrants from China last year. So I think the nature of immigration is changing. And by the time – this will stay the conversation for a long time, for the next few years at least, through the election season, illegal immigrants, crime. But we're kind of chasing the tail. I think that by the time we've tried to kind of caught up with those, we'll realize that the face of immigration has changed to higher tech jobs, to different countries, to the Eastern Hemisphere. So yes, when we're talking about the reforms, we're talking about all countries. Immigration law, with a few limited exceptions, is applied evenly across the entire world. But what's in the news and what we think about doesn't always match up with that.
Yeah, I mean, when you hear about immigration issues, you hear about putting up walls on our borders, and it tends to be focused on Mexico. And I agree with you. I think we need to get a broader perspective of that. So for those people that say, you know, why don't people just go through the legal process?
Sure, because for most people, there is no legal process.
Explain that.
So if you're in the United States already, for example, you can, with a few limited exceptions, really only obtain residency through family. If you marry a U.S. citizen, if you have U.S. citizen children, but even then, your U.S. citizen children can't petition for you until you turn 21. And unless you entered the country legally, you can't get your green card without spending 10 years outside of the country. So there really is no legal process for the majority of people. The idea that somebody from Mexico, for example, should have gotten a visa to come here just doesn't match up with how visas are actually issued. That is why, as we see, we're seeing the statistics change now. We're seeing fewer crossings from Mexico. What we are seeing is more people entering and staying, overstaying their visas. They're coming from different countries on visitor visas or student visas or temporary work visas and overstaying those visas. A few years ago, it was that, again, it's very difficult to get statistics, but a few years ago, it was estimated around 40% of the population that was here without documents had overstayed their visa rather than entering the country illegally.
Sure. I don't think the number is exact, but I think there's an estimate. If you're an adult trying to get in the back of the line, it could take up to 20 years.
Wow.
And if you're looking at families that are separated, I mean, 20 years without seeing your children, I mean, just something to think about.
Now, I do, you know, and as an example, in my family, we have a married relative who's married to someone who's an Italian citizen. And she was brought here as a child by her mother. The mother gained citizenship, never filled out the paperwork for the daughter, who came here at the age of, I think, 7. And she is an illegal immigrant here. She's been raised in this country and is now in her mid-20s. But cannot vote, you know, and could be deported in any period in time. And not somebody that typically, when we talk about an illegal immigrant, people put together with what their vision is when they're yelling and screaming about whether or not we should enact any kind of reform. If you just joined us on Central Coast Voices, our topic for discussion is legal perspectives on immigration reform policies and campaigns for immigrant rights and integration. Today's guests are Kevin Gregg, immigration attorney, Hazel Davalos, and president of the Latino Outreach Council.
I'm the organizing director with CAUSE, a community organization that works out of Santa
Barbara.
Oh,
okay. And Jacqueline Del Valle VT Frederick, did I say that correctly?
Pretty close, yes. Valle. Del Valle VT. Very good.
Viti Frederick, I'll get it.
Yes.
Who's just walked in and joined us, and we're glad you're here. Who's also an attorney.
Yeah, I'm an attorney, and I am currently the president of the Latino Outreach Council.
Okay, great. And our show is live, and you are welcome to bring your questions and comments and be part of today's discussion. The number to call is 781-3875. And we've been talking a little bit. We kind of took off the top we started with the discussion about what happened in San Francisco last week, and kind of how that kind of is something that can occur and was an unusual kind of an incident.
Well, I think this week's been a week that has highlighted a number of issues that have come up. One of them, the tragedy that occurred with the young woman who was killed in San Francisco. And then, of course, we have Donald Trump's comments and all the discussions that have ensued around that. So your selection of a topic this week couldn't have been more timely.
We actually had this on the books already.
I know you did. I know you did.
We didn't mean to stir all this up around
it,
though.
So, you know, the issues are very complex, and that's one of the things, as president of the Latino Outreach Council, is we're an education organization, and our goal is outreach to the community and education to the community. And, in fact, part of what we do is put on immigration forums. In fact, Kevin has been one of our speakers, and he attends our meetings, and we look to him for his advice and wisdom and knowledge with regard to immigration issues, because he's one of the few immigration attorneys in our county. But our organization likes to put a humanitarian viewpoint in outreach to the people in the community. And to do that, we have to understand what life is like for them. Our focus, of course, is Latino community, although it's certainly true that these issues affect people from all over the world.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And we were talking a little bit about that before you were able to join us.
I was listening in.
Yeah. So is the government doing what they should be doing in enforcing? And
is everybody looking at me for this one?
Well,
yeah,
should is obviously a very subjective term, but I do think there have been some good changes in the past little bit with what we were just talking about earlier regarding secure communities. Secure communities was the program that was put into place in 2007 so that that immigrants that were in local jails would come to the attention of ICE so that they could be interviewed. If anything, it worked too well. And anybody who was booked into a local jail was anywhere in the country had their fingerprints sent to ICE, and ICE would come and interview them. Initially, I don't believe the intention was to put every single person in deportation proceedings, but that's eventually what happened. Perhaps, you know, in search of numbers rather than results. So anybody that was put into jail for even for minor offenses or for charges that were later dropped, instead of being released, was transferred to immigration on that ICE hold. And that has significant effects on the community as far as separating from people from their parents temporarily or permanently in some cases, and had significant impacts on the actual deportation process. There's due process laws in place with the immigration law we have now enacted in the 1950s. As much as some people would like to think it's just that simple, you can't just pick somebody up and deport them. You have to give them the right to see an immigration judge, and that can be a long and sometimes years-long process. So ICE was able to get all of these people into deportation proceedings when they found them at local jails, but there wasn't an increase in resources to the immigration courts, increasing the number of judges, or to the prosecutors trying to present the government side. So you just kept increasing the number of people in immigration court without increasing the resources to complete the cases, and it just created this huge backlog, meaning it takes years, 4 or 5 years, for the government to deport somebody now, whether they were one of those people who was picked up with just a minor charge, or whether somebody who has multiple DUIs or domestic violence convictions.
And would people who were just randomly picked up because they didn't have evidence of citizenship also be in those same holding facilities?
So, I mean, to clarify a little, I mean, this program, they said, I set these levels of criteria. They said level one crimes, we're going to have the fingerprints sent to us, but we're only going to pick up people who are level one crime offenders, which is like violent crimes and some of the ones Kevin just mentioned. Twos and threes and non-criminals we're going to leave alone. We're going to see that they have their prints get sent to us, but we're not going to do anything. That was on paper. In implementation, the majority, if for example, in Santa Barbara County, the majority of people who were deported through the Secure Communities Program were quote unquote non-criminals based mm-hmm. on ICE's criteria. And so it's as Kevin just explained, on paper, it sounded good, but on implementation, it ended up sort of losing sight of priorities. I mean, there's no way, I mean, anyone can agree, there's no way they're going to be able to round up every undocumented person in our country and deport them. And so there needs to be some prioritizing. Let's get out the worst of the worst, the violent offenders. I mean, that's valid. But unfortunately, it's been low-level offenders and caused a needless separation of families. We have one case specifically in Santa Maria. A woman was stopped for driving on the cell phone or driving while talking on the cell phone. She's a mom. She just had a child 6 months before. She also didn't have a driver's license. That was before the recent passage of AB 60. She ended up in deportation proceedings. Thank goodness was able to prevent her deportation. But those are the kind of cases we're looking at. And it's around this technology. It's fingerprints. It's sending these prints to ICE without really the discretion of, you know, what kind of crime did this person commit? And as I mentioned, in recent years, we've seen more deportations than all of our country's history. And that's really created not only the backlogs that Kevin's speaking to in immigration courts, but also the foster care system. So many children have been left mm-hmm. without their parents. Mm-hmm. I myself have a cousin whose husband was deported. And her daughters are 5 and 2, and they don't have their dad. So you definitely see the human side and really the collateral damage from these new systems.
When you're talking about ICE again, define ICE. If somebody just joined us and doesn't know what that term is.
Sure. ICE is Immigration and Customs Enforcement. So after September 11th, all of the immigration agencies were combined under the umbrella of the Department of Homeland Security. And underneath that, there's Customs and Border Protection, which patrols the border and the airports. ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, which is responsible for removing people who are here permanent residents or people without documents, and United States Citizenship and Immigration Services, which reviews what we call affirmative benefits, people applying for their green card or for work visas or for citizenship. So ICE is for what we're talking about, ICE is the primary driver of the Secure Communities Program and of the Immigration Court.
If people are detained, where are they detained?
So there is a civil detention system throughout the country where some immigrants are detained. But because right now there's about 450,000 open immigration cases, obviously there's not the money or the desire to detain 450,000 people at any given time. So at any given time, there's about 30,000 immigrants detained, and the remainder are out on bond or out on their own recognizance, just like they would be for a criminal trial.
Are they detained within the criminal system?
They're generally separate immigration detention facilities that are operated by private contractors.
Okay.
That was one of the complaints about Secure Communities, is that hold required that the local jails keep the person there for at least 48 hours or for up to 48 hours, although they sometimes held them longer. And that was a big drain on resources to keep people there for 48 hours on the local government's dime when they had already served their local time. So after that, most people are either released or transferred to immigration detention.
And those are out of the area.
Well, I can speak to that. I mean, to offer a bit of a local perspective, in Santa Barbara County, we see people being sent to a detention center in Camarillo.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if you remember a controversial moment in Santa Maria just about a year ago. The city was proposing to build an ICE processing facility within the city limits, which spurred historic protests. 3,000 people.
And what is the status of that? What was the final upshot of that?
That would be a processing facility.
Right.
So it's where people would be kept, up to 12 hours processed before taken to Camarillo. But it's going to have its doors open any day now.
Oh, it is.
Uh-huh,
so it is.
This summer,
the city council did approve that, and I think one of the concerns, just again from the humanitarian standpoint, with that decision was the facility is being placed in an area where a lot of migrant farm workers come to work on the local farms. And I think it's very well known that many of our industries, including farming and services such as hotels, restaurants, we do rely on the immigrant and migrant worker, particularly in farming. So I think the message was very disturbing to many, that the city of Santa Maria would elect to approve that project right in an area where we do need migrant farm workers to come. I do know that there is a shortage of migrant farm workers, and it is having an adverse impact on farming.
Has there been more of a shortage since the announcement of the ICE facility?
I don't know in particular. I can tell you I think so from what I'm hearing.
Mm-hmm.
That there appears to be, I've spoken to some of the contractors who hire workers, and I know that there is a shortage of workers that are available in the strawberry fields and also the citrus and avocado orchards.
Mm-hmm. I can speak to that a little bit. I mean, the labor shortage was already beginning to happen due to the, like Kevin alluded to, I mean, there's been less entries and there's actually been a drop in the number of undocumented immigrants in our country for the first time in a decade. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And so for the first time you see signs, I mean, I live in Santa Maria, for the first time you see signs, hiring and growers actually have to try to find employees, whereas before, I mean, people were throwing themselves looking for jobs. And so that did aggravate the labor shortage, and many families did leave after that decision for fear of, an ICE facility being built in their community.
And for fear of deportation.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
So it's an interesting conundrum, because on one hand, we, these people do come here illegally to work, and yet we have built entire economies based on a reliance on them coming here to work.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it goes to the question that you posed earlier, is the government doing, and our legislators nationally and locally, doing everything that they should do on this issue? And I think the answer is clearly no. On one hand, we don't enforce the laws that we have on the books. There is an enormous number of people that do come here without going through the proper channels.
Mm-hmm.
And yet at the same time, we have whole economies and industries that rely on that type of labor force.
And we pretend like they don't.
That's right. So, you know, we used to have programs many years ago that accommodated for that. Mm-hmm. And it just seems so logical to me that some legislator should be able to come up with a program and a concept that will allow for people to apply and be here legally and, you know, take back money to Mexico to help support their families, because many of them do support their families in Mexico and other South American countries, and also keep our industries and farming industries going.
You're listening to Central Coast Voices on KCBX Public Radio, 90.1 San Luis Obispo, 91.7 Salinas to Paso Robles, 95.1 Lompoc, 90.9 Santa Ynez, and 89.5 Santa Barbara. The voices with me today are Kevin Gregg, immigration attorney, Hazel
Davalos,
who is the organizing director for CAUSE, Central Coast Alliance for a Sustainable Economy, and Jacqueline DeValle Vite?
Just Jacqueline Frederick is fine.
Oh, thank you, Frederick, who is an attorney and the president of the Latino Outreach Council. And I'm going to take a call right now. If you are interested in calling us, by the way, you can call us at 781-3875. And we have a call from Richard. And I'm going to go ahead and... Richard, are you there? Richard?
Yes.
Can you turn your radio down just a little bit?
Yes, I will.
Oh, thank you. That'll help. Okay, good deal. Richard, did you have a question or comment?
Well, I have a comment. I'm an expert on illegal immigration.
You are?
And I have credentials in government. I'm a retired professor.
Uh-huh.
I'm a liberal Democrat on most issues, but not on this. And my basic question is, you know, I know this issue upside and down, and they could immediately stop subsidizing the farmers by not enforcing the immigration laws by paying what that work is worth. That field work is very, very difficult work. And what we're doing is we're subsidizing the farmers with cheap labor, and that's what they want. And E-Verify is almost fail-proof now, and I could give you examples of why it's fail-proof now and it wasn't before. And my basic question is, oftentimes public radio only presents one side of an issue.
Uh-huh.
And I'm wondering, and this is my basic question, why don't you present the other side? Why don't you ask someone from the Federation of American Immigration Reform, which is the largest immigration reform organization in America, why don't you ask them to come on and present the other side? Why be so one-sided on this issue?
Okay.
I found a number of flaws on what you're saying, things that are just not true, what you're saying just now.
What, Richard, do you feel like is really not true?
Well, first of all, tell me why you don't present the other side by inviting Fair to come on your broadcast.
I think Mark Kerkorian is busy. I understand what you're saying, but a lot of those agencies tend to go on some of the bigger programs that I'm not speaking for KCVX, but we're all local members of the community, and I don't think there are any organizations like that within the community.
Oh, yes, there is. There's the California Immigration Reform Committee, which is, they're not a part of FAIR, but they take guidance from FAIR. That's one of the local organizations. I can give you their phone number if you want to call them.
Sure. And you can
346-2090.
Okay, and you're on this show right now, Richard. So
right.
I'm a
54-year resident of Santa Maria. I've seen the changes here.
Uh huh.
And I've also been in contact with one holding facility, which is in Avellano, California. And some of those people don't deserve to be in there. That's granted. But others, the vast majority, have committed big crimes. They come to Los Angeles and other major cities, and they get very deeply involved in drug sales. That's one of the biggest things.
Mm-hmm.
They're being held out there.
Okay.
They bring drugs across the border. And I'm not in favor of what Donald Trump said, but he's opened up this issue for discussion, which is good.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, Richard, this is Jacqueline Frederick from the Latino Outreach Council. I do agree with you that I think that this is a very complex issue, and all aspects of it need to be explored and reviewed. And, you know, we do need to get all sides of the perspective. So I appreciate the fact that you've called in and indicated that, you know, there may be another perspective. I can tell you for Latino Outreach Council, we are neutral. We don't promulgate one view. We're simply educational. So I'll certainly follow up and try to get more information, because I think that we all need to have a balance of information on all sides of the issue, because it's not an easy solution, and people need to come together on all the political spectrums, need to come together to come up with a solution for what has obviously been a longstanding issue in our entire nation and needs to be resolved.
Yeah, could I say one more thing about unemployment here? Most people realize that the unemployment figures are much, much higher than the government is telling us that they are. Example, Walmart here, their big food store, they needed 70 to 80 people to staff up that food store. They had over 3,000 applicants. One of the jobs around here. How many people know that Santa Maria High School and Pioneer Valley High School have 6 security people on campus during school hours and 1 full-time police officer? I've substituted there occasionally for the high school district, and I've seen the gang intimidation. We've got a terrible gang problem here. Many of them are made up of illegal aliens.
Well, I mean, that's a difficult factual statement to make. I think what we're getting at, California just was California just became there are now more Hispanic white immigrants than there are non-Hispanic, residents, not immigrants, residents. And what you're seeing, I would love to go do a headcount with you sometime, Richard, but I'm guessing that most of those are U.S. citizens. And I think when we try to conflate Hispanics and make an assumption about, and I know you said you're very schooled about it, and I'd love to talk to you off the air, but I think if you conflate Hispanic gang members and assume that they are all
illegal,
undocumented or illegal, as opposed to that being second generation or sometimes even third generation with their parents being citizens, that you're making a big leap there.
But Richard, thank you for calling in.
And in Swedish, which is an odd combination. My wife is Hispanic.
Well, thank you for calling in, Richard.
Richard, I seriously would love to spend some time with you if you want to give me a call.
Okay, and we have a call here from Hannah. Hannah, you had a question or comment?
Yeah, hi, my name's Hannah. I'm a local resident of SLO and currently go to school at UC Davis.
Uh-huh.
I'm fascinated by this radio segment. I normally don't tune in at this hour, but I did have a few questions for both of you. So I tuned in halfway through, so I guess my first question, if you haven't answered it already, is was this the installment of this facility that you're talking about in Santa Maria, was it a voter-based idea that went into action, or who was the proponent of this plan, I guess?
I can speak to that.
Sure, go ahead, Hazel.
This is Hazel with CAUSE. We were a community organization that advocated against the placement of that facility in Santa Maria. That processing facility was already functioning in Lompoc off of the federal prison grounds. And for reasons that still are not clear, ICE wanted to move to a place that I think was closer to the 101, just for efficiency purposes. And so they approached the city through the permitting process to be allowed to build that facility. And so they approached, you know, a developer who had land and sorted that all out and had to go to the city for permission to open up that facility. The reason it became a planning commission and a city council decision was that the facility actually wasn't fit for the zoning of the place it was placed in. And so it was up to the city planning commission and city council to vote to make that zone change so that that facility could open. Otherwise, they also could have opened up like any other business, but if they were appropriate for the zoning.
Does that answer your question, Hannah?
It definitely does, and it actually brings up more questions. I don't know how much time I have.
Go ahead.
I'm very intrigued. But so the City Council of Santa Maria, I'm a San Luis Obispo resident, so I'm not very sure. But is it a predominantly white council?
That's complicated. Yeah, it's not. If you were to look down partisan lines, it's a 5-member council and 1 Democrat.
Okay. Is there a lot of, I guess, in my, I just, my, the main question I have is like an ally of people who are illegal immigrants who are trying to, create ties in this country is like, what can I do as a constituent to become more educated and open up a dialogue myself in this local area about topics like this? I just don't feel like I have much exposure other than KCBX, which is a wonderful radio station, don't get me wrong, but I'd like to know what more I can do to become educated and start a dialogue about this topic.
Well, thank you so much for calling in, Hannah, and it's wonderful to hear. I think in the aftermath of that decision, it really opened up a lot of people's eyes to say, Santa Maria is a 70% Latino community. We're based on an agricultural economy that's highly dependent on undocumented immigrants. That's essentially the backbone of our community. Yet,
agreed.
The city council voted to approve this facility despite historic protests, 3,000 people, probably the largest in the city's history. And so it really did feel like a slap in the face and really as far as disenfranchisement and civic participation goes, I mean, it was a tough pill to swallow.
Right.
And so in the aftermath, I think as an ally, mobilizing voter power is one of the strongest things we can do. I mean, in this case, you know, we said, you know, we're a 70% Latino community, but it doesn't feel like the city council is reflecting that. And so after that, we pushed for voter registration drives. We were able to register 200 people right away after that issue, and especially Latino youth. I mean, look to your peers. Undocumented immigrants can't vote, but they sure have family that can. But unfortunately, and it's a funny statistic, when you look at naturalized citizens, people who are not born in this country but become a citizen, they're more likely to vote than their native-born Latino counterparts. Yeah, and I think it's because, you know, those of us who are born here, we take that for granted. And unfortunately, for Latinos compared to whites or other groups, we have lower rates of voter registration. And so for those of us who can vote, we need to. And for allies, it's get folks registered. I mean, if we don't agree with what our current decision makers are doing, then we have the ability to change that.
I really appreciate you talking to me. Thank you so much for sharing your story on air.
Thank you, Hannah.
Have a good day.
Bye. So let's talk a little bit about some of the resistance for immigration reform. Some of the resistance, I mean, we've heard different kinds of resistance. What would you say is the largest resistance?
I would say it's the fact that it's been expedient for both of our major political parties to use it as a political football. And maybe I'm being a little cynical about that, but it just seems to me that there isn't a real earnest effort to come together to resolve the problem and to join together on a bipartisan way to come to a solution. And I think it's very political, and I think that's
And you're
sad.
Saying by both sides.
I think so, because I think it's a decision that has to be made for the benefit of all United States citizens, and that includes people from varying different political perspectives. And I don't think it's a simple answer, and I would love to see our political leaders, our legislative leaders, make a decision that they're going to come together, because we are talking about human beings. when we talk about the issues that the immigrants face and that illegal immigrants face, what we're talking about are families, and we're talking about people's lives. And I think it's important enough that, you know, we do need to have both parties come together and take in all perspectives and come up with a bipartisan approach.
Is our immigration system as a whole broken?
I think it's hard to argue that it's not. The current immigration law that we have was passed in 1952, and everything has just been built on top of that. For something that, needs to keep up with a changing world, 63 years without significant changes to the root of the law is a pretty long period of time, and we haven't had any type of significant change to that since 1996, so basically 20 years. I think it's hard for something that changes so much to go such a long period of time without changing the law behind it. That goes into why it's so difficult to make those changes. It's huge. There's thousands of pages, and there's so many different complicated issues. We're talking about enforcement, about legal immigration, about temporary visas, about entrepreneurism. We're talking about so many different things within one law, and there's no stomach to fix one part of it unless all of it is fixed.
My mother immigrated here after World War II from Germany. And not an easy immigration, obviously, because she was German, and it was right after World War II. But that immigration process worked at that time. She became a citizen. She worked hard at being a citizen. How was the immigration laws, how were they different then than they are now? I mean, it wasn't popular to have Germans come over after World War II. And she went to a rural Ohio with my father, and that wasn't easy for her either. So it went, you know, it wasn't easy, but the system worked. What changed?
Generally, before that 1952 law, before that there were quotas, but not for Caucasians and Europeans. So that's largely – before that, you could show up if you were from certain countries.
What do you mean there were quotas but not for
– There were limitations starting – pretty much any immigration law starting in the late 1800s with the Chinese Exclusion Act, which
– so
guess what that did.
There could be only a certain number of Chinese that could come over.
Right.
Like caps.
And that applied to –
There were
to,
caps on
right.
different races.
Right.
Okay.
And that didn't apply to I don't know all the countries, but basically didn't apply to European countries. You showed up. If you were not ill, you were given a green card.
Okay.
And so that changed in 1952 and eliminated those caps so that things were more even. But it also they weren't going to say, okay, now anybody from anywhere can show up. So they set in place specific ways that somebody could get a green card, and that's specifically through family. Or through employment.
Now, can somebody who's here illegally marry and get a green card that way?
Yes, but it's not. It's a
not like in the movies,
without, right? No, yeah. No. Sandra Bullock and
yeah.
If the person entered the country legally, then it can be a fairly straightforward process. For somebody who entered the country illegally, the process can be very long, complicated, expensive.
Who entered legally and has an active
visa. Not necessarily active, but if they entered with a visa,
okay.
Purpose being, you know, somebody's here on a visitor or work visa and they meet somebody, we'd like to give them that option. It is much more complicated, and I can't tell you how many U.S. citizens I've had. It tends to be people that were born in the U.S. as opposed to naturalized who don't understand that the process is complicated. They think they can come to my office, and a week later, their spouse can go straight to citizenship. And I think if people understood how complicated the process was for spouses of citizens, even for people who are married to U.S. citizens, to get their green card, they might at least recognize that part is broken. And
how long does it take?
It depends on the person. For some people, it's 2 years. For a lot of people, it's never.
Yeah.
For a lot of people, there is no path. And without getting the specifics, the way it comes up most is if somebody ever left the country and came back at any point, they basically have to leave the U.S. for 10 years. And obviously at that point, you're not punishing the immigrant as much as you're punishing their U.S. citizen spouse who doesn't understand why they can't have the support financially and emotionally of their chosen spouse.
We're going to take a call here from Nita. Nita, are you there? Hello? Hello?
The radio.
Nita?
Listening online, maybe.
Nita? Kate, are you there?
Yes.
Hi.
I was just musing. The people coming into the U.S., I personally would have to give them credit for being determined and exacting, and probably some of the stronger people coming from Mexico that actually make it here, that somehow they should get some credit. What do you think?
Well, it certainly does take a lot of guts and courage to leave your country, your home, your family, your language, everything that you've known. And I think what it speaks to is in some of these countries, to put it mildly, the lack of opportunity and sometimes the dire poverty is so incredible that they really do make every effort and take enormous risks to come here. My family's from Colombia. I'm mm-hmm. also an immigrant's daughter, both sides of my family. I'm the first American. My son recently volunteered for a year in South America and stayed in a small town called Pasacavallos. And I say small town, but it was 9,000 people who lived basically in shacks. And the poverty when I went to visit was incredible. And I could just imagine when I was there that if you had an idea that you could provide a better life for your children, that you might take enormous risks. And I think that's what we're seeing. And anyone who travels especially to third world countries, mm-hmm. even some that are not so third world, but they have this incredible population of really poor people like we don't see in this country. We have such an amazing country here and provide opportunities that no one else has in the world, even in Western Europe. So this is why they want to come here and why they will take enormous risks to come here to better their lives and also better the lives of their children. I certainly think that was my family's story, and they came here legally, but this was in the late 1940s. Mm-hmm. And they did create a better life for their children. So this is why, and this is what we're seeing.
What that answer your question, Kate?
Yeah, thank you for your outlook. I agree with you. Thank you.
Thanks, Kate. We're going to try Nita again. Nita? Hello?
Hello?
Hi, Nita. You had a question?
Hello.
You had a question or comment?
Yes, I have a question about a problem that I think this country is facing with the immigration. I worked as a CPS social worker for 5 years in Santa Barbara County, and one particular case, and there was quite a few cases that involved illegal immigrants. One was a drug dealer who not only brought in a lot of methamphetamine, but abducted young girls and had some child pornography, and the whole thing came down to, okay, we're going to prosecute him. What will happen to him? And, you know, he had been, extradited twice before. So he's now serving 30 years in our prison system because we felt like it was came down to if you, you know, deport him, he'll come right back. He'll be back in 2 weeks. And so now he's doing 30 years. I now currently work in Salinas Valley State Prison, level 4. And we have many illegal immigrants in our prison system that taxpayers were housing for years. And so that's a huge problem. I don't know, And, you know, when you say, hey, close the borders, on the other half, I have a son, or, well, he's going to be my son-in-law, but he's also the father of my two grandchildren in Australia, and we want to bring him over here, and he's marrying my daughter, and we're working with immigration attorneys, trying to get him here to do that. And, God, I have to sign as a, even though he makes $200,000 a year and works for Fox News in Sydney, Australia, I have to sign for him as a financial supporter in case he, it's not an easy process.
Right.
And so I'm conflicted, quite frankly, because, hey, I'm one thing going, close the borders. We've got too many bad guys coming into the country, and it's not just Hispanics. There's a lot of bad people trying to get into this country. And then the other thing, I'm going, well, gosh, as we close the borders, how hard is that going to be for my new son-in-law?
Yeah.
So I am very trying to learn as much as I can around this issue because we're hoping he's going to be able to move here in a year.
I think you bring up the American dilemma here, and Kevin's smiling about this.
Well, I will say in relation to legal immigration is that there, people do get confused a lot. They're totally separate processes. The legal immigration system is a mess, and that has absolutely nothing to do with the borders or illegal immigration or illegal immigrants in jail. The legal immigration process is just a mess. It used to be much faster. It should be much faster. If you marry somebody, it shouldn't take at least a year and all of the, you know, and a joint sponsor and all the paperwork to get somebody here. And I'm saying that as somebody whose job relies partially on that process. So I think those are separate things. And that's where this hang up on closing the borders, which are, based on all statistics, are getting close to closed, distracts us from fixing the other issues that you know, people don't seem to notice until they actually have family members that are involved with it. In relation to the prison and jail issue, as far as I know, all those decisions are made in the criminal court absent immigration status. That it's not taken into account for the most part during sentencing or any of that. And yeah, it is a big problem. And the question is, you know, what do we do with it? Just with what happened in San Francisco, do we want to keep somebody like that in jail permanently here, or eventually deport him knowing that there's a good chance he'll try to come back? And I'm not sure there's a good answer for that, no matter what we do with the laws.
But thank you for asking that question, Nita, and for bringing up your dilemma, which is not alone for you.
Yeah, let me ask, would it be better if they get married in Australia before they come over and get married in America too, or you know?
Probably not, but give me a call. I can give you a little bit more specific answer to that over the phone.
Thanks, Nita.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
We have just a couple of minutes more, and anything really quick that you want to bring up? This is a topic that obviously we could do quite a few shows about, and we probably will do another show talking from both sides.
Sure. Well, I know. I think that conversation that just happened, I think it speaks to the need for real comprehensive immigration reform. I mean, crossing the border is a traumatic, dangerous process. I mean, it's getting harder and harder. I mean, you're walking through the desert, especially women, you're alone. I mean, no one would choose that if they had a legal path that was viable. And so that's what we truly need.
I want to thank my guests today, Kevin Gregg, immigration attorney, Hazel Davalos, who is the organizing director for the Central Coast Alliance for Sustainable Economy, and Jacqueline DeViti Frederick, I was going to say the whole thing, attorney. Perfect. Who is also the president of the Latino Outreach Council. And anyone who called in today, thank you very much for your voices. Central Coast Voices, sponsored by Action for Healthy Communities and the San Luis Obispo Community Foundation in collaboration with KCBX. I'm Chris Kington Barker, and thank you for joining me on Central Coast Voices. Thank you. Mm-hmm.